thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 43 for the 15th of September, 2009. Summer Wrap-Up. I'm Dan Cohen. Live from the Center for History and New Media, we are back, the Digital Campus podcast. I'm Dan Cohen. We have taken an impromptu summer hiatus, which we are glad to be back from. It's just been a busy summer for all of us, and we are glad that you are listening to us once again, and we are glad to be podcasting once again. I'm here, of course, with our regulars, Tom Scheinfeld and Mills Kelly. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
And Mills. Hi, Mills.
How are you, Dan?
Good. Great to be back on the podcast with the two of you. Usually we only have 2 weeks of tech and academic and university, library and museum issues and news to catch up on. This time it looks like we've got a whole summer, a lot to cover. I think what we'd like to do is start out with maybe some updates on stories we've covered a lot here on the podcast, and then maybe move on to some new things that cropped up over the summer that we think are going to be influential in this coming 2009 to 2010 school year. We also want to say that we are committed to keeping the podcast going despite our impromptu summer break. And to do that, we're going to introduce some changes to the podcast. We hope on the next podcast, Digital Campus number 44, lucky 44, we may introduce some changes that we will talk about as they come up. But thanks again for following us here via iTunes or live on the web at digitalcampus.tv. And also thanks to the over 600 people now who are following us on Twitter at Digital Campus, where you can suggest stories that you'd like us to cover, and also respond to us as we're podcasting. So looks like a bunch of issues we've covered on the podcast are really coming to a head this fall, and even perhaps in the next week or two. One of which, I guess, has been getting a lot of press in the news is Google Books and this settlement that they have, class action settlement with authors and publishers, or at least some authors and publishers, that, boy, really created a firestorm over the summer and really in the last couple weeks as the judge set a deadline for filing amicus briefings, you know, sort of suggestions to the court about what should go on. Again, for those new to the podcast and new to this issue, Google sort of just went right ahead and started scanning whole shelves of libraries about 4.5 years ago, and including books that were in copyright. And this led to a lawsuit and then a settlement between the American Association of Publishers, I hope I'm getting this right, and the Authors Guild, representing authors, or at least putatively representing all authors and publishers that might have a stake in this Google project. And of course, what Google wanted to do was to be able to show snippets or sections of books that even were in copyright, the authors and publishers considered even the act of scanning it, even for search purposes, to be an illegal act. And we've now reached the point where we're really closing in on sort of final arguments and ultimately a settlement. Sort of thumbs up, thumbs down from the judge, although I guess another option would be some kind of tweak to the settlement. We can talk about some of the things that have gone on recently. But boy, the heat on this issue has really grown, hasn't it, Mills and Tom? You know, just this week, the Mary Beth Peters, who's the head of the Copyright Office in Washington, D.C. for the federal government, really whacked Google over the head with a statement in front of the House committee looking into this issue. I think a lot of people were taken aback by the by her fairly aggressive statements about how she thought that parts of the settlement were completely improper and usurped copyright law. What do the two of you think is sort of happening at this point? Where are we as of this recording, which we're recording on September 11th, 2009?
Well, I think the fact that it's gained the notice of Washington and politicians is important, because it had really, I don't think it had gotten that kind of notice previously. And I think really, to be honest, what prompted that, what made lawmakers sort of wake up to what was going on, is something that happened in August, which was Microsoft, Amazon, Yahoo, and a bunch of other very large, very important companies in the business, joining with the Internet Archive in something called the Open Book Alliance to challenge this settlement. And so once those, you know, really high profile entities were on board, and it wasn't just, you know, the American Library Association and you know, us kind of academics howling in the wilderness, once it was these big moneyed industries and big moneyed interests complaining about this, Then I think Washington has woken up to it. And I think, you know, putting some political pressure on the courts is you know, it will make a difference. And I think it probably will affect the outcome. I don't know, Dan, as you said, if we're going to get an up or a down outcome from the judge. I think there's kind of a middle ground that we might get, which is a sort of sending them back to make some changes to the agreement. And if I had to guess, that would be my guess, that the judge is probably going to send them back to come up with a new draft, essentially.
This new organization, for listeners, is at openbookalliance.org, and obviously this is you know, a coalition, as Tom said, of those who are against the settlement. But there is a lot of good resources, and I think they're tracking the news pretty well about what's going on in the settlement. You know, I suppose we should say the crux of the issue is really this segment of books. One of the main complaints is about orphan books, right? Which are these books that are in copyright, that is, most books in the United States that were published after 1923, but whose authors, you know, kind of no one can find. And that's actually, it's quite a few books. I mean, it's over a million books. I've heard different numbers thrown out, but it's certainly seven figures, so quite a few books, and Google's sort of just saying, well, you know, these books, you know, we they're neither here nor there. We kind of, you know, should have the rights to do something with them under the settlement. And a lot of people are saying that you know, basically gives them a monopoly over this segment of books, and also books where, you know, the authors, and there surely there will be many of them, just sort of haven't really acted to opt out of this settlement. We should also say that, you know, this is a global issue. The settlement is applicable in the United States, but the, you know, there are lots of countries in the European Union are expressing serious misgivings about this, including the federal government of Germany, I believe, and others in Europe, libraries and organizations.
Well, I think that, you know, we're getting close to the end game on this, at least this round of it. I think it'll probably go on beyond this particular court action, because either Google will appeal or the other parties are going to appeal. But I think that, you know, they've kind of, that everybody involved is sort of focused in on just a couple of key issues now. And one of them is the one that Mary Beth Peters raised, from the Chief Copyright Officer of the United States, raised about what amounts to sort of a compulsory opt-out license for copyright holders. You know, so, okay, I wrote a book. Google, under this settlement, has the right to scan that book and create commercial products from that unless I opt out. So it's now incumbent on me to contact Google and say, I don't want you to do that. I think that creates one set of issues. And then the second is, it's still unclear what kinds of secondary commercial products Google can create under the terms of this settlement. And until that's defined by Google and by the other people involved, I think they're going to have a hard time pushing this through.
Right. There is this larger issue about commercialization, isn't there? I mean, there aren't dollar amounts specified in the settlement. You know, there's a lot of people saying, well, we sort of have to trust Google that, for instance, pricing for libraries for access to this set of books will be reasonable and will remain reasonable even in the future, as, you know, let's say they have profit pressures or things like that. And then what else are they going to do with these books?
Or other people running the company.
Right. I mean,
so,
that's right.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's imagine a circumstance in which Google does find itself in a slightly more competitive environment than it is now, and their pressures on their business and their stock value has gone down, and a consortium of Chinese investors comes along and buys up all their stock, or enough to get a controlling interest of the corporation. But at that point, you know, the horse has left the barn. You can imagine all the sort of the fulminating that'll go on in Congress and the public about, oh my God, we just sold our entire copyright legacy to some group of Chinese investors, and all this sort of economic nationalism will surface. But then it'll be too late, because Google is a corporation which is publicly traded and so therefore belongs to its stockholders, will be able to do whatever it wants. And so, you know, it would be a hard one to then file a suit about.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's the, with all of these kinds of private ownership of knowledge resources, I mean, this is the problem, is these companies are and should be responsible in the end to their shareholders. And so, I mean, that's, And they should be, like, you know, Google should be doing what's right for its shareholders, not what's right for copyright holders. I mean, that's not really their obligation, to their shareholders. And I don't think we can fault them if they decide that to make a business decision that is good for their shareholders, but bad for, you know, education and the diffusion of knowledge and all of those good things. So we should think about that when we do these kinds of deals. At the outset, we can't just trust them not to be evil.
Isn't this a larger problem that we're going to encounter with Google in the coming years, or that we've already encountered, in that from the start and even today, when you look at the way Google is run, it's a company, but it's also kind of a university. It's kind of academic in a way, right? They hire smart people. Everyone knows they're kind of the Harvard of tech companies. They take the best PhDs. They have a kind of academic environment where people are allowed to do 20% research, in the same way that sort of professors are allowed to kind of do their own thing 20% of the time. And haven't they and also we set up unrealistic expectations about Google as they do things like, you know, they launch a site, for instance, on Google Apps for Education, which they're pushing really hard. We'll link to this from digitalcampus.tv, but they have a kind of evangelism website for Google Apps for Education, in which they say that more than 5 million students are already using Google, and they're using it for free. And that means that these universities are saving a ton of money in terms of servers and IT staff. Doesn't Google have a kind of frenemy problem at this point? They're sort of frenemies of the universities, if I can use that word.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think we all love Google. You know, if you wanted to be a bit of a conspiracy theorist, you could say that they've, you know, lured us all in with this, you know, with this nice line about and this kind of ethos of openness and collegiality and cooperation and collaboration, and goodness, essentially. And you know, once they've, you know, reeled us in, they could turn on a dime and start, you know, they could start charging for those email systems. I mean, once all these universities have moved to them, they could, you know, raise the price.
Oh my God, then they would be Microsoft.
Well, right. They right. would
I mean, this
be.
Is sort of, in a way, isn't this sort of our objection 10 years ago about Microsoft, is that they kind of controlled you know, word processing and internet browsing and all of those things. And this is what we hated about them, but especially because then Microsoft Office costs a lot. And so Microsoft at least came in through the front door.
Right. At least they were upfront about it. Yeah. That's a great point. But I mean, on the flip side of this, you know, maybe just to take Google's perspective for just a second. I mean, isn't there a lot of kind of sour grapes complaining here also in academia about Google? I mean, just to look at the Google book search, which I have qualms about as well. But I mean, this is a company. I mean, after all, Microsoft dropped out of this business of scanning books and losing money scanning books. And here's a company, Google, that has committed hundreds of millions of dollars to scan, you know, 15 million books and make a lot of them available for free online. And aren't we, you know, I mean, academics are critical, of course, but you know, you could imagine, like, if Google built Widener Library at Harvard, you know, we'd complain about the number of steps it would take to get up to the reading room.
I do and I don't, but the difference is, I mean, the difference is, like, why isn't Harvard doing this? Why aren't universities doing this? Why isn't a consortium of universities with, you know, a combination of foundation and government funding doing, you know, the open version of Google Books? You know, why can't we get that funded? Yes, it's $100 million or $200 million or $300 million, but, you know, I mean, in the big picture, that's not that much money. I mean, that's not that much money. Even, you know, NSF, what is their budget? Several billion dollars. NIH, their budget is, you know, several or a couple tens of billions of dollars. So to put all of the books in the United States online for free and in a publicly held repository for $300 million, we're really not talking about all that much money. It seems like it's a little lazy. Is Google saw an opportunity for, you know, what they saw as a fairly minimal investment to control all of this knowledge, and that's worrying. It just, I guess my problem with it is that it seems like we've just been lazy. That it's easier to let Google pay for it and not worry about the consequences than to try to actually raise the money ourselves.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, you think about universities, just to go back to Harvard for a second, although now with their financial arm again, they're not doing this. But, you know, they were in the business of building, you know, $100 million science labs not so long ago,
right,
for things like genomics that are incredibly expensive. And you could think that at, you know, evidently at scale, you could do a book at $10 a book. So, you know, $100 million gets you a lot of books, can't, and even at $30 a book, you know.
I'd be interested to see how much Widener Library cost when it was built.
Right. Or how much
in 1909 or 1915 or whenever it was.
Right. Or the aggregate acquisition costs are surely billions of dollars to build up.
So, I mean, you know, if you're talking about $300 million, what, you know, $10 million for 30 years, we'd have this, or $30 million over 10 years, we'd have this, and it would be public. It doesn't seem undoable to me,
right,
with the amount of money that's funding. And we're not just talking about the humanities in here. I mean, we're not talking about IMLS funding this or NEH funding this. We're talking about, like, let's get NSF involved. Let's get NIH involved. They have big budgets. This is doable.
It's doable, but not practical, for the simple reason that you've just named a whole bunch of different organizations that would have to be involved, and just the number of meetings that would be required to get everybody on the same page would take 2 years, if not longer, and then the negotiating of the boundaries of the agreements would take another year, and so by the time academia was actually ready to do it, Google would have finished.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, that's where they have the real advantage, is that they only have to marshal their own troops and then they go.
Right. Mills, could I ask you just to speak up a little bit?
We can hear
you, but I'm worried that our listeners might not be able to.
Sure.
You know, if Bill Gates really wanted to stick it to Google, he would fund this himself. I mean, you know,
great,
I mean,
idea. Yeah.
Again, $300 million for Bill Gates is actually not all that much money either.
Right.
You know, it sounds like a lot of money, but when you talk about, you know, all of the million-dollar grants that are given out by all of the funding agencies and all of the foundations, if you pooled some of those, you'd get there relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right. Okay. Well, I think we probably need to move on, but I suspect we're going to be back on this issue once the filings are done and we get some response from the court. And maybe we'll ask maybe someone from Open Book Alliance and Google to come on the podcast at a later date, hopefully not to have a John McLaughlin style yelling match, but to have some some kind of cogent or calm discussion about where we are and where we're headed in terms of these digitized books. Well, I guess a related update would be on the ebook front. Boy, this summer saw a lot of these ebook readers come out. Sony issued a few new models, that some of them relatively inexpensive. I think they're now under $200. I think there's Plastic Logic has something coming out. There was another UK brand, you know, now we're starting to get these like off market brands that no one's ever heard of.
IREX.
IREX, and then IREX, there's something and... reader. It has just a really simple name.
Well, and I'm starting to see students on campus with them.
Are you really?
Yeah, not a lot of students, but some. You know, sitting in our student union building or sitting in a classroom building, you know, looking at their ebook reader rather than at a book. I mean, and when I say some, I mean, you know, fewer than 10 so far this semester, but they're out there. They're starting to show up.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I think like Amazon with the Kindle tried to make the play that Apple made with the iPod. They tried to get in. They saw that there were these, you know, there are these ebook readers out there, and you know, some people were using them, but they weren't very successful in the way that in 2001 and 2002, Apple saw MP3 players. Like, but they knew the future of music was digital, and they knew, and Amazon knows that the future of reading is digital, and so they basically came in with this Kindle. It was closed. You had to use Amazon's. You had to buy your books from Amazon. It was this kind of closed hardware software platform, and you had to use the Amazon hardware and the Amazon software to make it all work together. In the way that you have to use the iPod with iTunes, it's all one piece. And I think they tried to get in early and corner the market that way. The question is whether with these new entries from Sony and from Barnes & Noble, whether they'll be able to add some competition and make the ebook reader space a competitive space. In a way that the MP3 player space is not competitive anymore.
Right.
I mean, Apple's got 80-something% of the market.
Right. I'm sorry. That UK brand is called Cooler, for some reason with a dash between the L and the E. I'm not sure quite why, but Cooler Reader, which looks like it's kind of neat. It's got a little click wheel that looks exactly like the iPod Nano click wheel in the bottom right. And then everybody's using the same e-ink, you know, shades of gray 5 or 7 inch screen, so the screens are almost identical on all these, and then Asus is coming out with one, and Asus is of course the manufacturer that basically created the netbook, the cheap mm-hmm. notebook market. So they're coming out with one that's going to be dual screen, so you open it up like a book and you actually read something on each side. So if they're getting into this market, and one assumes they're going to produce something cheap just like they did in the notebook market, something's happening here.
And if Apple, I think Apple is thinking that if all the speculation about Apple coming out with a tablet is correct, a touchscreen tablet PC. If Apple comes out with that, that essentially is going to function as an ebook reader as well, I imagine. So there is an awful lot going on here.
I guess a related update is just on, you know, from an academic perspective, really a push toward textbooks on these devices as well. Mills, you've talked to Stan Katz recently. We had him on the podcast in the spring, and he was planning on using e-readers in his fall class. Is that right?
Yeah,
Stan Katz of Princeton. Yeah.
I don't know which class he's actually using it for, but he is using a Kindle in one of his courses, and I'd actually hoped to be able to go up and watch and see what was happening. Unfortunately, it happens to be the same night of the week that my class is, so I couldn't do it, but I'll be real interested to hear from Stan how it goes, and he's promised to be available to give us a report sort of midway through the semester.
Right, so a lot of these new readers, he's using the Kindle DX, which is that large form factor reader from Amazon. Almost all of the rest of them are now using the Kindle DX, I'm sorry, just to back up a sec, reads PDFs, which is, I think, one of the main innovations, and I think one of the reasons it became very attractive for academia, because so many articles are in PDF. But a lot of these new readers are using the EPUB format, which is an open format. It's not the Kindle format. It's not a closed format. And there seems to be a big push toward EPUB here that I wonder if that's the underlying story, or perhaps in the long term a more important story that's going on here, is the rise of a kind of standardized electronic book format or electronic article format that formats really well on these different devices and is open. And so, for instance, just at the end of the summer, Google announced that they were going to reissue, I think, 1 million of their public domain books in the EPUB format. Right now, you can download them as PDF, but they were going to rework them as an EPUB book, which means that, for instance, the Cooler device is going to offer 500,000 public domain books. The new Sony ebook reader that came out this summer is offering, I think, 1 million of these free public domain books. So you sort of get a big chunk of books on them if you use the EPUB format.
Yeah, I think that is hugely important. I think that's the difference is with these new readers using this EPUB format, this open format, are they going to be able to compete with Amazon's, you know, more kind of closed, more, you know, it's like the Apple experience. It's seamless. It's beautiful. It feels unified and holistic, but it's closed. You know, I think this on the other side, there's like the PC world, and I think this other world of these ebooks, where you know there's a lot of different kinds of hardware, but all that different hardware runs the same software. And in this case, it's that EPUB format. And so there's kind of two models there: one which is, you know, closed and controlled, but offers a kind of unity of experience, and one which is open and a little more chaotic, but you know, which holds out the hope of interoperability and some openness, sharing of these books and other things. And I, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I think we're seeing in some ways a repeat of what we saw with the personal computer, and then the MP3 player, and now here with these ebooks.
Right.
Well,
okay.
And I think one of the things that Amazon's going to find difficult right away is, you know, the Kindle is just so ugly. And these other readers, if you take a look at them, they've got, you know, you can get them in 8 different colors or 12 different colors. I mean, people will be able to express themselves a little more than just something putty colored, like the good old fashioned IBM PC of yore.
Right. Well, I guess we'll have to see what happens. I mean, I suppose just Tom looking at that history. I mean, we know what happened in the PC world, that Apple's closed platform, at least for much of the history of computing, lost out to the, you know, make any hardware you want and it'll run Windows world. But then in the iPod world, it ended up being the opposite, that these closed systems ended up being the monopoly. Ebook readers, jury's still out, huh?
Yeah, I think we'll see. And I think we're going to actually probably begin to see by the end of this year, we're going to have an idea of which direction this is going.
Yep.
Okay. Well, again, to be continued. Let's move on to from the news from the summer, things to watch, things that came up this summer that we here on the podcast think are going to be important elements of the next year, or indicative of important trends in technology and academia, museums and libraries. Well, I guess, you know, probably the one that got the most hype was this Google Wave introduction over the summer. What are we thinking of Wave? And maybe we should just say for those in the audience who haven't spent the time to watch the hour and a half Google video that they have of what Google Wave is, which really was oriented, I think, probably more toward developers, software developers, rather than end users. This is a kind of Skunk Works project that their team, I think mainly in Australia, tried to reconceptualize, you know, if you were starting now, what would email look like? And what they came up with, I suppose, could be described as a hybrid of a messaging system, that is, a system that passes messages back, like email or IM, between various people or groups, and also newer elements of the web, like wikis and mashups, embeddable content like maps, etc. And they kind of threw this in a blender and came up with Wave. I guess that the name Wave is meant to imply that rather than getting an email or a thread of email, you get a single wave that kind of persists and sort of bobs up and down as everyone who's reading it edits it, makes additions to it, etc. And what you get then is the ability to, let's say if you're going out to dinner and you've got a group of people, you wave them, I suppose. I don't know what the term is going to be. And then everyone can kind of write in the email live, and these additions or edits get propagated out to everyone looking at this wave, and everyone can say what times they're available and what restaurants are good, and someone can throw on a map and see me there. Is this important? Is this just a lot of bells and whistles, but isn't really important, especially for those of us in our line of work?
I think people are going to have a hard time finding where it fits into their, where this new model of, you know, it's like collaborative email almost, or collaborative messaging. You're kind of where this fits into their current workflow. You know, I think email worked and remains the killer app, because there was like a clear metaphor to what came before. You know, there was a clear analogy, like, this is email. This is like mail. It's just on your computer. And so you could say, how do I use this? I use this instead of writing a letter. Okay, so like that makes sense. So I used to write a letter, now I write an email. That sort of makes sense. I know where that fits into my everyday kind of workflow. You know, other things I think you know have been like this. You know, instead of, you know, like a wiki, like okay, I use a wiki. I use that instead of using a notepad, or you know, so like you can kind of make an analogy to what you did before. I don't see really where that analogy is with Wave. Like, what is it replacing? What is it? What am I doing now that this is going to help me do better, or just a little bit differently, but in a, you know, in a quicker, more efficient way? I don't know if there's really that analogy. And to have kind of widespread adoption, I sort of think you need that, like, very quick statement of what it is and what it does to say, like, you use this instead of writing a letter, and somebody says, I see. Okay, I'll do that. That's what I don't see with this, but you know, I haven't used it, so I guess I'll have to see. But that's my early sense of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm always thinking about these things in terms of how they might be used in teaching, and one of the things I'm especially interested in is getting students out of the classroom and sort of moving around in the public at large, rather than just sitting in a classroom tied to a desk. And so I can imagine again, none of us have actually used this thing, but I can imagine that for some kind of, you know, group place-based computing effort, it could actually be kind of interesting in a classroom context or a non-classroom context. But I'm just going to have to wait and see. So, and I would want to know, like, how easily usable is it on various portable devices like iPhones, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mills, on the various devices. What struck me, really, I mean, if you look at the demo, is how web-centric it is. And isn't the innovation here going to be related to mobile? I mean, how are you going to edit wiki-type objects on a 3-inch screen? Their whole demo really focuses on having a large monitor. But I also like your other point about, you know, maybe there's some version of this that's great for classroom use, where students can collaborate on a project, let's say, you know, quickly put together a chart, or, you know, an article on some topic, and, you know, using that. And obviously the Wave is private, so they don't have to, like, put it up on Wikipedia or some other place. Or you could use it in place of the clicker in the classroom if you wanted to do a quick poll or something like that. You know, I mean, they're trying to really create a platform, and that's always tricky, right? It isn't just a simple technology. If you watch the whole video, I mean, they talk about things like you could create bots, you know, these automated software agents that change the Wave as things happen. So, you know, you could embed a traffic map of, you know, getting to the restaurant, and then there'd be a bot that would update the traffic so people could check in. It just seems like it's a little bit too much right now, at least from this video, of a solution in search of a problem. I mean, people have kind of ad hoc ways of doing a lot of this. If you want to arrange a meeting time with your colleagues, you can use what is the service, Doodle, where it just gives you a chart and you just click on the hours you're available, and then it spits out a result at the end. So people have kind of made their way around a lot of these issues. And I think, Tom, your point about the metaphor becomes really difficult. I mean, I guess the larger problem here is just that people who are so immersed in the technology, it's hard to see what the 90% of people who are not on Twitter or not using wikis would want out of the technology, and how to, you know, you can't just push this stuff on them, can you?
What percent of people are not using Twitter?
Okay, 99%, Mels.
Oh, I feel so much better.
I mean, I think there's probably uses for it, and I'm sure there'll be creative uses for it. But I think Google's problem was when the announcement came out, I think the initial announcement was like, this is the future of email. And it's sort of hard to see just yet how, like, this replaces email. I don't see that happening. But I think it's totally possible that some of the interesting uses that Mills was talking about and Dan, you were, I think that's possible that those will come to pass.
Well, I guess a related kind of summer wave, another kind of wave of technology that's come in that might be important over the next year, and certainly Wave is trying to capitalize on is real time, right? It isn't the point of Wave that as various people edit it, you can have eight people edit the same document at the same time. The updates are propagated out. And we saw a lot of movement this summer toward these kinds of real-time interactions. I mean, Twitter is, I suppose, one symptom of this, and it's clearly instigated a lot of thinking about this kind of real-time social media. There were a bunch of technologies, some with better names than others. Dave Weiner, who created the original RSS spec that runs blogs and podcasts that pushes out new content, came up with something called RSS Cloud, where he's trying to create a kind of system of technologies whereby RSS goes more real time. I mean, if you subscribe to a blog, you might not get a new post from that blog for anywhere from 15 minutes to a few hours, depending on your blog reader, your news reader. He's trying to get that down to a fraction of a second. And when that happens, you can start thinking about new forms of real-time interaction. There was another spec with the horrible name of PubSub Hubbub. Someone should be shot for coming up with that name. That does a similar sort of thing also kind of deals with real-time communications. And toward the end of the summer, we saw, I think it was WordPress.com, the makers of the great open-source WordPress blogging platform, and this is their commercial hosted version. I think they adopted RSS Cloud, if I'm not mistaken, and I believe Google Reader adopted PubSub Hubbubs so that they can also do real-time updates. So there's something afoot here in terms of real-time communications that certainly we're going to look for in the next year. Isn't that right?
I think, I certainly think that people are, I think the real issue is trying to aggregate the massive flow of information that's coming at us. And I think all of these things are an attempt to do that. And I still haven't seen one that's going to solve that problem for me. I mean, for me, the problem is solved largely by removing myself from a lot of that flow of information. So until somebody comes up with something, RSS Cloud, I've looked at it, didn't really look like it was going to solve my problem, so I didn't actually use it. But the flow of information is vastly exceeding our ability to cope with it.
Yeah, I think if these kinds of things are going to be successful, and I do think that's where we're headed, and I think Twitter sort of points in that direction. I think we're going to all have to get used to not reading everything, and feeling comfortable with that, and feeling comfortable with, other people not reading everything you send them. I think where, I've gotten used to, when I first started on Twitter, I used to like go back at the, when I woke up at 7 a.m. and look at the Twitter stream from the night before and try to like read all the tweets of all my friends who, what they posted over the, over the last, 8 hours or 9 hours or whatever.
And then you had a baby and couldn't do that.
But I've gotten really comfortable with I check in with Twitter when I check in with Twitter. And if I miss something, I miss something. And I think we're going to have to get more comfortable with that in terms of reading blog posts and maybe even in terms of reading emails and stuff where you kind of dip into it. I've heard a lot of different metaphors for this. Like one is, you kind of wade in the stream of information. You kind of put your feet in when you want to, and you let it flow past you, and then you take your feet out, and you don't get what's flowing by. And now I've heard another metaphor, which is, the cocktail party. Like if you show up 20 minutes late to a cocktail party, you don't go around asking everyone at the cocktail party what transpired in the previous 20 minutes. You just sort of accept that you're coming in, in midstream, and you kind of catch up, and then you leave, and maybe you rejoin later. And that's kind of fine. in that way, it's more like a conversation, and it's fine to just sort of come in and out of it. You don't have to read everything. And I think we're going to have to get comfortable with that if these things, if this is the future, we're all going to have to get comfortable with it. And we're going to have to get comfortable with our colleagues and friends, maybe not keeping up with every single thing we say. That's just sort of an observation, not really a comment on whether this is going to happen or not. But I do think we all have to start getting comfortable with that idea.
Right. I hear you on that. I think the danger for those of us in the kind of technology side of the academic world is as these technologies, these real-time technologies increase, I think it sets us up for a pretty harsh criticism from those. In the same way, there's been the slow food movement to attack, you know, the rise of fast food. I think we're probably going to see some kind of attack on this real time. Okay. Any other new news from the summer? We saw Steve Jobs this week up on stage. Anything, you know, he's always got his finger on the pulse of new technologies that are going to influence the way we do lots of things, not just in academia. Every student's going to have a camera, I suppose, now with the camera on the iPod Nano, which is their most successful model. Is that going to have any impact? A video camera, I should say.
I think it's possible already.
Yeah, I think it's possible. I actually thought the big story out of Apple this summer was sort of that there was no story. I feel like Apple's in the sorry situation of having to announce something big every time they announce something, and you know, that's a hard expectation to meet. And I guess I didn't see a whole lot there. But I do think, the increasing ubiquity of cameras, especially video cameras on campus, is gonna change things. I think it's also gonna change things in museums and libraries. We're gonna see a lot more audience produced or visitor produced video and audio and imagery coming out of museums and libraries. So I do think that's a continuing story.
Okay. Yeah, I think the other thing that's going to happen is we're going to see more faculty members on YouTube.
Right.
Students right. Sit in class and videotape and put up, you know, here's my really interesting or really boring professor.
Right. I think what's really interesting now, there was a new update to iTunes this week, and some of the functionality had to do with better organization for iTunes U. And if you look at these updates, I mean, you can really set up a whole core system now in iTunes U. I mean, you can arrange a whole set of classes in it and put podcasts together, and it's going to put a lot of pressure on professors if we're still going to go by this lecture model and they're all going to get videotaped to be a bit more entertaining, I suppose. Okay, well, I suppose that's our wrap up from the summer for now. We've probably missed some things. If you can think of anything that we missed, feel free to send us feedback at feedback@digitalcampus.tv, or you can send us a reply on Twitter at Digital Campus. Let's move on to picks for the podcast. Okay, for those who are new to the podcast for the 2009-2000 school year, we end the podcast with some picks of interesting things you might find online, interesting devices, anything that might be useful to your life that we found useful to our life. Tom, why don't we start with you?
All right, I've got sort of two things, two Linux or Unix resources that people can take a look at if they're interested in Linux. The first one is something called Sugar on a Stick. Sugar is the flavor of Linux that runs on the one laptop per child. It's sort of a education-focused flavor of Linux with an interface, with a user interface that is geared towards really towards kids and the way they might want to use a computer in class and outside of class. And Sugar on a Stick is a version of Sugar which it loads onto a USB memory stick, and you can boot from the memory stick. So if you stick this memory stick in any PC into the USB port of any PC and startup, it will boot Linux from that USB stick without affecting the rest of your computer. So let's say you've got Windows running on your main machine in your office or at home, you can put this USB stick into the USB drive and boot up in Linux, and it won't affect anything on your hard drive. It'll just run directly from the flash drive, and it there's enough space there to save some documents and certainly to surf the web and to install a little bit of software. But it's a good way to try out Linux and to get a look at one laptop per child and what that environment looks like if you haven't had a chance to do so on the OLPC on the XO itself. So that's kind of a nice little resource. And then another thing is a blog post from actually a former intern of ours at the Center for History and New Media, Adam Krimble, who's a graduate student of Bill Turkell's up at the University of Western Ontario. His blog, Thoughts on Public and Digital History, he had a great post over the summer called Learning Unix, and it gives some links to some resources for learning some pretty basic Unix commands, especially if you're running Mac OS. If you open up a terminal window, that is a Unix command prompt that you've got there. And if you want to learn how to use that command prompt a little more effectively, Adam provides some resources and also a kind of a tutorial, a few simple tasks that you can perform to kind of get your skills up to speed and to hone those skills if you've got some already. You know, how to copy a file, how to make a new directory, how to move between directories. He's got a nice little tutorial written up there. So just a plug for a former intern of ours and a student of a friend, and in general, the blog is a great little blog. So not actually a little blog. His blog is certainly he's posting a lot and a lot more than I am. For sure, and it's a great resource for a lot of different things to do with public history and digital history. So Adam's blog is something to check out too.
Great. Again, we'll link to all these resources from digitalcampus.tv. Mills, what do you have for us this time?
Well, mine is also a somewhat connected to us blog post, and this is one by Rob Townsend at the American Historical Association. Many of you know Rob got his PhD recently from our program, and we're very proud of him. And he had a very interesting post on the 1st of September called Is There a Future for Journals in the Humanities? And it's really a nice summary of a much more extended report from the National Humanities Alliance called The Future of Scholarly Journal Publishing Among Social Science and Humanities Associations. And so, I mean, this is an issue we've talked a lot about on the podcast, the future of journal publishing and, you know, what does it mean when they stop publishing print versions. And so this report from the National Humanities Alliance takes that on. But if you don't want to read the whole report, I would suggest reading Rob's AHA Today blog post because it summarizes the issues very clearly.
Okay, great. Just checking it out right now. Again, we'll link to that. Is There a Future for Journals in the Humanities by Rob Townsend of the American Historical Association. I have a general blog to recommend that just launched, did a stealth launch over the summer, but is now live and includes many friends of the podcast as bloggers on the site. It's called profhacker.com, profhacker.com. And it's a group blog of a lot of very savvy technologists, some professors, some people in academic technology, some in the library world, it's just got a terrific series. I mean, this is a must subscribe, I think, for people who are subscribed to the Digital Campus podcast. But it covers pretty much everything from productivity to pedagogy to, you know, using tools, Firefox recommendations, Google recommendations, Microsoft recommendations. They have weekend reviews of what's gone on. They're just doing a real terrific job, and I want to give them a major plug from the podcast. Again, that's profhacker.com. Subscribe to it from your favorite blog reader. Well, Mills and Tom, thank you very much for rejoining the podcast with me. I think the three of us are glad to be back on our horses and ready to ride on the podcast. And again, we'll let you, the audience, know about changes that are upcoming to the podcast. Tom, I want to thank you especially for stopping on a trip to New York in a Panera in Delaware to log on. It's great to have you on via Panera Wi-Fi, which worked remarkably well.
Right. Thank you very much to Panera for the coffee and for the Wi-Fi.
This podcast sponsored by Panera. Panera.
No, that
for all your Wi-Fi and bread needs. Okay, I wish we had product placement, but we are a free podcast available at digitalcampus.tv and, of course, also on iTunes. We want to thank everyone for listening in, and we hope you rejoin us in 2 weeks on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.